and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about our public conversations, the ideas that have formed us, and how to have better conversations across difference. In this episode, you'll hear a talk I had with Tom Holland. Tom is a historian, biographer, and broadcaster. He's the author of Rubicon, Persian Fire, Millennium, and In the Shadow of the Sword, among many others. He has just published Dominion, which tells the story of the influence of Christianity on the Western world. We spoke about losing his childhood faith, falling in love with the classical world, and why he'd really like to believe in God. I hope you enjoy listening. Tom, I'm going to kick off with the big question, which we start every podcast with, and I still as yet haven't managed to create a pithy definition of. I'm going to ask you about your sacred values, and by that I mean deep principles that you try and live by, things that feel very uncomfortable when there's the threat of them being compromised and that you think might be fundamental to who you are. Having had a bit of time to think about it, what came to mind?
I think that the principles that are sacred to me, as with most people, are the principles that I was brought up with. And those principles are fundamentally Christian ones. I would say that there are two in particular, both of which clearly derive from my Christian upbringing. One is a conviction that all human beings are equal, reflecting the biblical notion that all human beings are created equally in the image of God, which gives them a special dignity. And the other is that the rich, the strong, the powerful have a duty to the poor, to the weak, to those who don't have power. However, I have to issue a caveat, which is that I find nothing that makes me believe that the duty to, or the responsibility to have these values is an objective one. I can easily imagine being brought up in a different time, in a different place, and believing very different things. And although I recognize my upbringing as having been a deeply Christian one, it's also been shadowed pretty much from the age of six by a nagging anxiety that the world might be actually a far more frightening and carnivorous place. And that's due to my earliest childhood obsession was with prehistoric life. And so the earliest picture books that I was obsessed by showed sauropods being attacked, slashed to pieces, devoured by a variety of carnivorous dinosaurs. And in a sense, that also, I suppose, is a part of what it, you know, if it's saying sacred, a sense that, and maybe almost a Nietzschean sense, that there is also something within life that is frightening and unsettling. So that's the kind of shadow, I suppose, of my values.
You were brought up by a deeply Christian mother. Is that a fair description?
Yes.
But your father didn't have any particular belief.
I still have basically no idea what my what my father's beliefs are. He's a very private man. He certainly didn't go to church. I suspect that he doesn't believe in God. He's certainly not a practicing Christian. But to my mother, yes, it was very important part of her her character, her emotional and moral and spiritual responses to life was absolutely founded in a notion of Christianity that came to her when she was a young woman who came to London. I think was quite lonely and discovered deep friendships in a church in London, and it has shaped her life ever since.
In interviews before, you've talked about this. You've talked about an ebbing sense, ebbing away of a sense of God, or a certainty of the Christianity that you'd experienced as a young child. And it sounds really not at all traumatic when you've talked about it elsewhere, that it just sort of drifted away.
Yeah.
Is that, tell me more about that, because that feels like it might be real to some people's experiences, but for others, there is more grief around that loss.
Well, as I say, I mean, it was from a very early age. I remember going to Sunday school, and there was a children's Bible, illustrated Bible. And on the first page, it had Adam and Eve with a brachiosaur in the Garden of Eden. And I knew that human beings had not existed with dinosaurs. I mean, it was the first thing that you learn when you become a dinosaur enthusiast. And so I asked the Sunday school teacher and said, what's going on here? And not only could she not answer why, but she didn't even seem to recognize that this was an important issue. And it was, I suppose, every child goes through that crisis point where you realize that actually adults don't know everything. And even more unsettlingly, you know things that adults don't. And that kind of then, I suppose, shook me up and gave me a very kind of late Victorian crisis of faith, which was a kind of bubbling away underneath. But it was focused on all the things that caused crisis of faith after Darwin. It was all about, you know, survival of the fittest and this deep sense of geological time and all those kind of issues. And I think also it was a kind of psychological and emotional one as well, because my interest in dinosaurs, big, fierce, glamorous, extinct, moved seamlessly into an interest with the ancient empires of the Near East and the Mediterranean. So Rome, Greece, Syria, Egypt, Babylon. And I remember, you know, I was fascinated by the Bible. I loved reading it. I loved the stories. I loved the way in which it was clearly part of the fabric of this broader history. But to be honest, I was more interested in that than I was in the patriarchs or even, you know, in the figure of God himself. So, you know, if I was reading the New Testament, I was much more interested in Pontius Pilate and the centurion and his slave than I was in Jesus, to be honest. And I always had that sense that the Greek gods were just much more interesting, much sexier, much more glamorous than the biblical God, which didn't mean that I didn't respond deeply and emotionally to the Christian story and to the biblical narrative. I did. It's just that it felt to me that they were kind of like competing radio stations. And I was, you know, I would enjoy both, but I found the music that was coming from the Greco-Roman musical station more appealing.
As you're speaking, it's almost as if the story you're telling is of almost the brutality and the suffering and the sex and the power of, I mean, obviously there was sex with the dinosaurs, but, you know, the
dynamic of power, of sexual power in Greece and Rome. Yes, yeah. I recognize now as having a very early erotic charge.
Yeah.
My grandmother had a book of Greek myths, and looking back at it, that it was full of classical sculpture, but also kind of faintly fetid Victorian paintings of these scenes. And they all involved kind of gods raping mortals. And I found the power dynamic kind of exciting.
And it also sounds like you found something there that felt more true to your experience of the world. Is that fair enough?
Well, no, because my mother's love, the love of my godmother, who was also very important to me, was also a very devout Anglican. That seemed absolutely true to the way of the world. And I recognize now, looking back, that actually the Greek myths didn't configure the way that I thought, that I felt, that I believed, in the way that actually the story of the Passion did. Ultimately, I recognized that the story of the Passion was the deepest. It was the one that penetrated most deeply into my emotional makeup, into my intellectual makeup as well. But it's taken me time to recognize that, I think. And certainly, when I kind of weigh up the appeal of the carnivorous take on life and, let's say, the Paschal take on life, it's taken me time to recognize that actually the whole of the Paschal take on life is deeper and profounder.
You write beautifully about your godmother and being at her bedside when she died and the strong sense she had of a hope of that not being the end.
Yeah.
And you walking, I'm going to make me a bit teary, but you walking out and feeling strongly that you know, the matter and energy that made up your godmother would remain in the world, but that was all that there was. And I've been really fascinated reading your book and reading interviews with you, because perhaps more so than some of the other atheists that I've interviewed, you sit in this fascinating liminal space, it feels, between acknowledging the power and the goodness and the emotional and psychic pull of Christianity, but also most of the time speaking as someone who's just straightforwardly atheist and doesn't believe.
Well, I don't think I am straightforwardly atheist anymore.
Okay.
I certainly was. I mean, I would say that I was kind of closer to agnosticism. I was never militantly atheist. And the reason I wasn't militantly atheist was the same reason that I felt suspicious of highly religious people. It seemed to me a form of Puritanism. And I think that even more fully now. So it was closer to agnosticism. And the agnosticism was a kind of, as I say, a kind of inability to decide between the ways in which all these various cultural influences, emotional influences were pulling me. But I think that the conclusion that I've come to is that you asked me what my sense of the sacred is, and I said, you know, the conviction that all human life is sacred, the conviction that the strong have a duty of care to the weak. But I can find no basis for that that doesn't depend ultimately on the kind of mythic status of really of the crucifixion, I suppose. I mean, that seems to me what lies at the heart of the civilization that has generated these ideas as its core values, and attempts to state them as somehow philosophical or political or moral principles that can be followed without the animating power of that myth seem to me to be faintly anemic. So I powerfully believe in the story of the crucifixion and the resurrection as a myth. And oddly, one of the things that I have found helpful over the past 2 years, and it's a most unexpected person, because I had viewed his writings as a kind of adolescent fling that I'd massively grown up from, was the writings of Tolkien, who was obsessed by myth and a devoutly believing Catholic, and talked about how myth can be true. And I suppose that's where I am at the moment. I believe that the Christian myth, in some deep psychological, emotional, spiritual way, is true. Now, whether that in turn means that the Lord Jesus Christ rose from the dead on the third day and is seated at the right hand of God the Father, you know, that's harder for me to believe. But it may be that having acknowledged the myth that lies at the heart of Christianity as true, it may be that I will come to that, and I would welcome that. Like Agent Mulder, I want to believe. And there are times when I do believe. You know, there are times when I believe. There are times when, you know, at Christmas or Easter, or you know, when you're at places where, you know, thin places, places where the divine seems to intrude upon the mortal, or where I read certain things, or where I contemplate certain people who seem to me to particularly embody Christian truths. And I do feel this kind of, I think, oh, this must be what it's like to believe. It's a kind of, when you take an ecstasy pill, the onset is a kind of glowing. It's a kind of golden glowing in the blood. And I imagine that faith must be that kind of ecstasy, and that's why it's called ecstasy. And there are times where I feel it, and then it kind of fades away again. But, you know, I would love to feel that.
I'm really grateful for you being as honest and as open and as vulnerable as you have been for a while about the complexities of belief and identity and wrestling in public. And whenever I'm kind of probing around people's beliefs, I feel a strong sense of responsibility and duty of care, because there's such a power dynamic in our public conversations about everything, about belief and non-belief. And I feel the background roar of the tribalism that drives so much of us, and the sense in which all of us, and Christians are as guilty of this, as we kind of want to stick our flag in people. Like, I know for so many people listening who are Christians, hearing you, they'll be going, they're just cheering you on. They're like, come on, Tom, and they'll be praying for you. And
I'm very, very happy for them. Yeah. You know, I'd love them to. Yeah. Like, you know, I hope their prayers are answered.
Yeah, and you know, but that's beautiful and good. But I know that for many humanists or atheists, they probably feel the same thing because we love to belong and we love people.
Yeah, but
that
they're all basically the same.
What?
Humanists and self-confessing atheists are, you know, in this country, are essentially belong as much to Protestant sects as Anglicans do. I mean, they're clearly part of that rolling evolutionary process that that generated the Reformation, that generated the Enlightenment. And, you know, humanist values are essentially Christian values.
So let's dig into this because it's clearly one of the things that will come up in the commentary around the book that you've got increasingly clear, as many people have in public life, that, you know, John Gray being key proponent, that humanism in particular is, you know, he calls it a Protestant heresy or, you know, a form of Christianity. And you know, I've spoken to lots of atheists and humanists on the podcast, and when I ask them what they find difficult, and Andrew Copson in particular said this, they often say they feel like the things that they hold sacred are always being claimed by other people and pulled away from them, and the sense they often feel is that they're being told that the things they believe are not really theirs, or they're not really valid, or they're not really legitimate. And there's kind of tribal and narrow responses to it. And then there's, I think, a sense of genuine perplexity about how to respond. So as you're making that case, how much are you thinking about how it will land and how to help the people that you want to persuade hear that? How much have you kind of lost patience with that?
I'm not trying to persuade anyone. I'm not here as an evangelist. I'm saying what I think. This is my judgment on the process of how and why I think we as a society tend to believe what we believe and what its relationship is, not just to the immediate past, but to the deep past. And, you know, in a sense, it's personal to me because going back to what I was saying about this kind of divided self, the, you know, Athens and Jerusalem, the Iliad and the book of Jeremiah, there is a tension there. And my instinct had been to imagine that essentially I was, you know, a Greek, but the more I've lived in the minds of the Greeks and the Romans, the more alien, the more terrifying, the more peculiar, the more strange I find them, the more alienating. And essentially, I wrote a book on the fall of the Roman Republic. I wrote a book on the Persian Wars. And when you do that, when you kind of imaginatively inhabit the minds of people like that, it's kind of like a marriage, but you get to know them in a way that you don't if you just study them. And I found that process unsettling. And so that's what then made me interested in Christian history, because I began to think, well, actually the things that I think clearly come from, you know, they're clearly Christian in inspiration. So that's really been the process. So I wrote a book about Latin Europe in the 10th and 11th centuries. And this is the new book, Dominion, is really an expansion on that, to see whether this thesis holds water, to test whether you can indeed trace a kind of evolutionary process by which Christianity does emerge, obviously, out of the melting pot of the Roman world in the first century. You know, elements from Judaism, obviously, from Greece, from Rome, from Persia, all these elements mixing together, but creating something that does seem to me quite radically new. And then tracing the course of that evolution, or rather, let's call it an earthquake, the ripples that as they spill out into the present day. And I have no doubt that in its essentials, in its fundamentals, our civilization in the 21st century in the West is utterly saturated with Christian assumptions. And those assumptions are not necessarily predicated on a belief in you know, a creator God. It's not predicated on the reality of Jesus rising from the dead. It reflects a 2,000 year process of cultural change. And in a sense, the very idea of change, the idea that just as the individual can be born again, just as the individual can be washed of its sins, just as the individual can be brought to a better understanding of what is truthful, can gain enlightenment. So also can a society. And that, of course, is fundamental to Paul's teachings, most famously in the beginning of John's Gospel. But it becomes societized in the 11th century in the Latin West, in this extraordinary process of revolutionary ferment in the 11th century. And it establishes a template that we've never really escaped. The reformers in the 11th century, who seized control of the bishopric of Rome and turned it into an agent of revolution, an agent for transforming society top to bottom, from who aimed to cleanse the whole of the Christian people and to bring them to a new understanding of their purpose. This process was called Reformatio. It was about turning, about changing, about remaking. So what we call the Reformation is merely another iteration of that. And so is the Enlightenment, so is the French Revolution, so is so is wokeness. Wokeness is about, it's about awakening.
So that chapter was fascinating to me. The kind of later chapters where it just felt like you were pointing at everything and saying, look, Christianity, the Beatles,
I feel like the father in the Goodness Gracious Me sketch who says, Indian, everything's Indian. I mean, that's what I feel like. Not everything is Christian, but in its fundamentals it is. And I think that the question you ask, where atheists say, why can't our beliefs just be ours rather than deriving from Christianity? What you'll find with humanists in particular, and this is something, again, that goes back to the Enlightenment, Voltaire was always doing it, is a desire to claim that the specifics of Enlightenment are somehow universal. So you find them in ancient Greece, for instance, you find them in China, you find them in India. In other words, it's this idea that Enlightenment is something that just kind of hovers imminent in the atmosphere, waiting to be brought down. But of course, that's in itself is a massively kind of,
it's a myth.
It's an absolute myth. And you'd think, why would an atheist worry about where his or her beliefs come from? I mean, what does it matter where they come from ultimately? Why the anxiety to say, well, it comes from, Greek philosophy or whatever, rather than what it obviously does come from? And there's clearly kind of Oedipal anxiety there.
Let's ground it in something really specific, because we had a fascinating Twitter interaction with an atheist and philosopher called Stephen around the article that you wrote in The Spectator that was kind of laying out the thesis of the book. And he was clearly deeply offended, which is why I've been trying to think to this question. I'm always interested in the kind of emotional power of these reactions we have to the other and to arguments. And I was trying to ask, I hope, kind of open-handedly and open-heartedly, like, help me understand why, if you're an atheist, it wouldn't be okay to say, look at all this great human knowledge that came through the medium or the delivery method of Christianity, that actually there feels like something offensive to some people in your argument. And what I got to was, he felt like you'd overstated the case, but also he just didn't trust your motives. And I feel like that is a thread that goes right through so many of these tricky things in public conversation, that actually the things we disagree on are much narrower than we think, but we just don't trust each other's motives. And we're always seeing power grabs. It was all a complicated way of setting up my question about the role of history and the way history is used and the way we claim ownership for it or use it to legitimize and delegitimize things. How, as a historian, do you see that as kind of a moral purpose? Do you see that as a vocation? How kind of lightly or heavily do you carry that responsibility?
Well, I think that my personal understanding of a historian's duty is to be true to what he or she thinks actually happened, and to attempt to understand what actually happened to the best of his or her ability. Now, that understanding of history is not itself, of course, neutral. It's one that Eusebius or Gregory of Tours would not have recognized. But that is what I that is what I hold to. And I think that in holding to that, I am representative of most people who write history. But there is also an additional dimension to my interest in history. I'm not an academic historian. And so there may even be people who would doubt that qualifies me to rank as a historian at all. But my interest is in the fact that history is really the only branch of academic knowledge that is simultaneously a form of literature. And I'm interested in the writtenness of history. And I'm interested in the way that myths are themselves, they're not just generated by the processes of history, but they determine and affect how we understand those processes in turn. And the Christian myth, of course, is the most influential myth of all time. It's the most influential myth that humanity has ever devised. And the myth expresses itself in the West in particularly distinctive forms. So there is the primal Christian myth, which all Christians share, which emerged in the first century AD. Then there is, the myth that is generated in the 11th century, which runs from the Middle Ages right to the present, this idea that governments should have a kind of moral purpose, that it is the role of society to wash itself of its sins, to be born anew, that the functioning of history should somehow have a moral purpose that expresses itself through the doings of the powerful. Then there's the myths that are generated by the Reformation. There are the myths generated by the Enlightenment. There are the myths that have been generated in the 20th century and now in the 21st century. But all of these myths, in their fundamentals, it seems to me, are Christian. And I suppose the philosopher who has recognized that most acutely is Nietzsche. And so in that sense, I suppose that Dominion, my book about this, and indeed my understanding of history, is an ultimately a Nietzschean one.
I always enjoy going back to read Nietzsche just because he feels like the philosopher that's got the most punchy prose. And
well, I over the course of researching and writing this book, obviously I read an enormous amount of apologetics from the New Testament itself right the way up to the present day. But I have to say that of all the writers I read, no one made me feel more wholly Christian than Nietzsche, because Nietzsche hates Christianity for the reasons that most people admire it. And he is an atheist because, how can I frame this? Most atheists, when they abandon, if they don't have a belief in Christianity, nevertheless want to keep hold of Christian morality. They may attribute, they say, well, this is just the way it is.
We hold these things self-evident.
This is what human nature is. We hold these things to be self-evident. This is what science proves. Of course, it doesn't at all. We hold these beliefs because this is the result of the history that has generated the society in which we live. Nietzsche really detested those beliefs, and that's why he became an atheist. And the great shadow that hangs over us is that, although Nietzsche himself was very philo-Semitic, great admirer of the Jews, so not a nationalist that he gave up his Prussian citizenship at an early age and remained stateless for the rest of his life. Nevertheless, his rejection of Christian morality, in a way, his blaming of the Christian eulogization of the weak on the Jews, fused with interpretations of Darwinism to create the climate in which Nazism then became possible. And I think that the shadow that hangs over our post-Christian society is a kind of terrified awareness of what actually happens when you get rid of Christian morality. Because we know, we've seen it. I talked about the two guiding principles, my two guiding values. The Nazis existed consciously to repudiate those. The idea that Aryans were superior to Jews, that Jews were a lesser form of life, that therefore they should be eliminated. And also the idea that the strong should prevail over the weak, that
the disabled or whoever should be euthanized. These were fundamental to what the Nazis saw as being good. The Nazis didn't set, you know, the whole point of the famous Mitchell and Webb sketch, Are We the Baddies, is the Nazis didn't think they were the baddies. The Nazis thought that they were the goodies. They thought that they were uprooting this slave morality that had held back their race. They thought that it was the right thing to do. And ultimately, I don't see how you can argue that necessarily, you know, objectively, that that's wrong. If you don't think that there is a mythic quality that sustains the values that oppose them.
So I wanted to ask if, having read seemingly everything ever written around Christianity, although that's probably impossible, because the sense from your book is the diffuseness of the legacy and also how it can take people in completely different directions. You know, Merkel's immigration policy versus Orban's immigration policy. You know, you say the cultural wars in the States are not basically Christianity versus progressives, but a civil war between Christian sects. Yeah. Given how the fruits are so diverse, did you come to a conclusion about what is the essence of the thing?
I think that there is a massive tension at the heart of Christian universalism. I think the universalism is the kind of the key idea that emerged, and this is why Christianity is so successful in the Roman world, is that in the Roman Empire, this bringing together of different peoples into a single framework of administration. There are all kinds of attempts to provide a kind of philosophical or spiritual or framework for what the Roman Empire has generated, of which Christianity is one. But it's the most successful, and it triumphs because it provides the peoples who live within the Roman Empire with a sense that actually the world that they now inhabit as Gauls and Arabs and Italians and Spaniards, that this is reflecting God's purpose, that God has indeed created all humans in his image. And so it gives them a kind of dignity that corresponds to the state within which they exist. But there is a tension there that is inherent, implicit, right from the beginning, when Paul famously says, you know, that there is no Jew or Greek in Christ Jesus. And this seems to us a kind of noble idea that you know, there's no black or white, you know, we're all the same. But what if, you know, you're a Jew and you don't want to have your identity dissolved into a kind of slushy universalist mush? And that's, Paul is already waking up to the problem of that, you know, in his letters. And it's an issue that's there in Christianity, right from its very, very beginnings. What do you do with people who do not want to be part of what you feel is right, of what is universal? And that's the tension that lies to this day in liberalism. What do you do with people who don't want to be liberal?
I'm going to slightly out myself, not fully, but what I'm going to say sounds extremely evangelical, and some days that's exactly what I am. Just depends what day you catch me. But as I was reading, the phrase I used to, that kept coming to mind was fruits, not the roots. And not you, but in general, I am suspicious of people who call themselves cultural Christians, because it feels to me like Christianity and its power and its mythological, you know, resonance can be and has been repeatedly used as an kind of excluding force or a nationalistic force or a political force. And that those, and we see, you know, one in the White House, those who want to use the power of Christianity without submitting to what I, and of course it's subjective, feel is the heart of it, which is this kind of the weakness and the defeat of the cross and the kind of self-giving, self-sacrificial laying down of power grab, are almost worse than those who say...
Cultural Christians are not the first to have rejected those who are not Christian.
Yes.
You know, this is, again, is something that goes back a very, very long way.
Yeah.
You talked earlier about how both Merkel and Orban in their approach to the migration crisis are both deeply Christian. Of course, the idea that you should help the suffering and the weak and the poor is the fundamental Christian value. The parable of the Good Samaritan. I mean, that's the essence of it. You know, the Samaritan
helps the Jew. That's the point. But equally, you know, it goes back to this idea of what do you do with people who don't want to buy into those values, and what you do with people who want to overthrow Christian civilization was an issue that Christian Europe faced in the early Middle Ages when confronted with Vikings or Magyars or Saracens or whatever. And so that has been a tension in the idea that you should just turn the other cheek and love your enemy. And in Hungary, it has a particular resonance, both because the Hungarians, the Magyars, were themselves predators on Christian Europe and were then converted to Christianity and became great bulwarks of Christian faith. But then, of course, were conquered by the Ottomans and subjected to Muslim rule for a very, very long period.
That's a very helpful bit of the story to remember.
I think it diminishes the moral demands that Christianity and indeed Christian civilization generally places on people if that dilemma is kind of underplayed. Because, you know, had the Vikings succeeded in eradicating Christianity from England, then the notion that you should love your enemy would have vanished from England as well. And then what?
Thank you. It's a live kind of tension for me, in the sense that, you know, one of the hats that I wear, one of the things I do is I lead Theos, and Theos exists fundamentally to make the case that you make so brilliantly in the book, that these ideas and this legacy and these communities are important and in the main a force for good, and we shouldn't overlook them as sources of wisdom just because we've got so used to it and they're no longer
fashionable. But I would say more than that. You say it's a force for good. I would say that the definition of good is a Christian one. You know, because people say force for good unthinkingly. I'm not saying you are, but our understanding of what is good is not, you know, it doesn't just come from anywhere.
Yeah.
It's absolutely culturally conditioned. I suppose if you're a Christian, you'd say, well, it's the manifestation of the spirit.
Yeah.
But, you know, you don't have to be Hegel to say that, to secularize that notion of the spirit. We are, in that sense, the spirit of Christianity continues to animate us. I mean, the best metaphor for it came to me watching Chernobyl, you know, the recent drama series, where there's an amazing sequence where you see the radioactivity smashing up out of the reactor and ionizing the air. So you can see the process. But of course, simultaneously, that radioactivity is invisible as it starts to spread towards Kiev and then across Scandinavia and across Europe. And this radioactivity that is leaking from Chernobyl is invisible, but is no less powerful for being invisible. I'm not saying that Christianity is radioactivity, but it is certainly transformative in that way. And it changes you, even if you're not aware that it's changing you. And even if you can't see the air being ionized by it, you're still breathing it in.
I'm going to ask my last question, and it's been so fascinating that we've run out of time to do a whole section that I wanted to ask about the public conversation about Islam and your experience of writing about that and experiencing a significant backlash and death threats and various things, which I'd love to talk to you about another time, but you've spoken about elsewhere and I will try and point people to it in the podcast notes. But so from that experience, from being a historian over these many years, from as you're preparing to launch another book and launch into all the conversations that you'll have about it, what have you learned in public conversations about what works for helping us to understand each other and enrich each other better, rather than our public conversations just for sites of having the same old arguments that go round and round again based on our tribal lines?
Okay, well, what I think is that a society cannot function unless it has a controlling myth. And I think the controlling myth in our society is that of secularism, that somehow the secular is neutral, and that those who uphold the secular state are somehow neutral umpires between those of different faiths and those of none. That is clearly a myth. Secularism is a specific and utterly contingent product of the civilization of Latin Christendom as it has evolved over the past 1,000 years. And
the obligation, not just on Muslims, but on Jews, has been to reconfigure themselves as they have to think of themselves, if they're to function as citizens in Western states, not as belonging to a people, so not as belonging to Israel, the people of Israel, or to the Ummah, but to something called a religion. And that concept of religion, certainly in Britain, is a very Protestant one still. It's one that Catholics also have to subject themselves to, I think. And the process, certainly, you know, as Jews found over the past two centuries, has been a Procrustean one. It's required them to kind of stretch bits here, to lop off bits there, to reconfigure their understanding, to accept that they belong to something called Judaism, which is a Christian word dating back to the second century AD. It's not one that Jewish intellectuals ever thought. But Jews in Britain basically now are obliged to consider that they belong to a religion called Judaism. And the same process is now happening with Muslims. And essentially, that is the framework within which difference can thrive. But if you're in the greenhouse, you're not aware that you're in a greenhouse. It looks like it's all multiple plants growing freely. But we are in the greenhouse. And in that sense, those who are not of Christian heritage are, I think that they are at a disadvantage. I think they are obliged to accommodate themselves to this kind of framework of Christian assumptions that has evolved for so long. And I think that creates pressures and strains on them. And I think you see some of the strains are evident in the anti-Semitism crisis in Labour at the moment. But also you see the strains in the way that there are Muslims in Britain who clearly do, whether inchoately or whether they understand what the problem is, they do feel that they are disadvantaged. And I think that they are disadvantaged. And that then becomes the appeal of the appeal of belonging to an ummah, of rejecting the idea of a nation state, rejecting the controlling assumptions of secularism. And I'm kind of torn between whether it's better for people to recognize this or whether we should just carry on, it's the noble lie. But I do think it's a noble lie. I think secularism is a noble lie.
And to be kind of painfully practical, what could or should that mean for how we navigate across difference, say across the difference of belief or non-belief or with a Muslim or a Jew? Are there things we can do, ways we can talk, assumptions we can challenge that just surface some of those tensions?
Well, I'm not a Jew or a Muslim, so I wouldn't feel that it's my role to say. I do not think it's going to change. I do not think that you can suddenly introduce, the jizya or anything. I mean, it's just not going to happen.
What's the jizya?
The tax that the Quran mandates should be levied on Jews or Christians in exchange for their freedom to practice religion. Which was kind of taken for granted by every Islamic state that existed up until the 19th century, when they were basically forced at British gunpoint to abolish it. That's not going to go back. The Christian assumptions that governed why the West got the Islamic world to abolish the jizya, that's not going to go back on that. So I think that I think probably we're better off not dwelling too much on the historical processes and pretending that secularism is culturally neutral. But I think we shouldn't be surprised at the resulting strains.
Tom Holland, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you for listening to The Sacred. I'm Elizabeth Oldfield. The producer of this episode is Nate Bethay, and it is a project of the think tank Theos. We'd really love to hear your thoughts, whether via Twitter @sacred_podcast or me @TheosElizabeth or thesacredpodcast@gmail.com if it's easier to write in long form. As always, please do rate and share so others can find the podcast. We're also now available on Spotify, so it's even easier to take The Sacred with you wherever you go. Finally, if you'd like to know more about the work of Theos, you can connect via the website at theosthinktank.co.uk.